Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Monday, February 11th. Cloudy, some scattered morning flurries. Today's high 30. Tonight, a winter weather advisory from 9 p.m. till midnight. 3 to 6 inches of snow moving in. Steady temperatures near 30. And then for tomorrow, Tuesday, a bit more snow, maybe another inch. Also some light freezing rain in the morning. Tomorrow's high 33. Right now, it's a battleship gray sky, 28 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha, wind from the northeast at 10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a master's degree in clinical mental health counseling. Work as a licensed professional counselor or mental health and wellness advocate. Details available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we explore the fascinating and important topic of cybersecurity. In part two, you will meet the son half of the father and son piano duo team of Ryan and Ryan. My conversation with Baron Ryan coming up later in the hour. Stay with us.
For the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show, we are going to try to probe into a complicated topic and one that is of mounting concern to more and more people, that of cybersecurity and the possibility that all of us, and in so many ways, are more and more vulnerable to different kinds of cyber attack. And this is something that, of course, our nation is needing to wrestle with on kind of a nationwide scale. But it is also something that can affect individuals. Individuals can be subject to attack, and so can businesses. The book that I'm holding is called Cybersecurity Program Development for Business, The Essential Planning Guide. And in this book, the author, Chris Moscovitis, tries to help the typical business owner understand what is at stake, the healthiest way to sort of think about risk and threat, and what sort of systems of protection can be, in a sense, the most meaningful and most effective. Chris Moscovitis is founder of TMG Media, a consultancy focused on providing independent technology and cybersecurity management expertise, development, and outsourcing services. He is very busy, as you can well imagine, in this day and age when this is of mounting concern. The book is published by Wiley. Again, it's titled Cybersecurity Program Development for Business, The Essential Planning Guide. And Chris Moscovitis, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Greg, it's a pleasure to be here.
So explain the void that you believe your book fills, because certainly there has been plenty written about this whole area, this type of threat, but almost all of the books, in your opinion, that have been written thus far either haven't gone after it the way you have or have done so in a way that has not always been particularly effective. In a sense, what kind of void were you trying to fill with the writing of your book?
Well, I was trying to bridge a communications gap because you're right, Greg. There has been a ton of books written on the subject, the vast majority of which are highly technical and very sophisticated books, and they contribute to the field without a doubt. But one of the failures that we have had, both as technologists and as cybersecurity professionals, is to develop an ability to communicate with our business stakeholders, with our elected officials, and with one another. So it is as if we speak a foreign language to one another. So what this book is trying to do is, you know, demystify the subject, keep it pragmatic, explain what's going on, and enable a handshake between people that are genuinely concerned about their data, about their business, about their community, with a cybersecurity professional that says, okay, what do we do about this? What's going on? What's happening? So that's what the book has tried to do, and I have had the privilege and honor to receive very positive feedback about it.
Very good. I was intrigued in the more extensive small autobiography that's in your book that you mentioned starting your own company back in 1989.
That's
and
right.
We're
30 years old today.
Right.
Not today. We're 30 years old this year.
Right. And it's just intriguing to think about how much has changed between 1989 and now. Could you just say a word about the challenge that you and others in this field have faced in terms of riding the waves of one technological breakthrough after another, and in particular, the way in which the very nature of risk and the kind of threats that we face have changed so dramatically?
Well, Greg, you're absolutely right, and it has been quite a ride since 89 to now. When I started in the business, which was even before I formed my own company, email was between academic institutions. I was using something called BitNet, sending emails from universities to universities. Now email is in our pockets. The cell phones, I remember having the first luggable and paying an arm and a leg to make a call. So today, cell phones have way more power than the space shuttle. So the changes have been dramatic. I have been always interested in cybersecurity and protection of systems since I started the business, and when we were offering consulting services, that was certainly part of the suite of services that we were offering even back then. I had a partner at the time by the name of George Whalen, and one of the things that George used to collect, and he still has it, is a floppy disk. If you remember floppy disk, he has floppy disks with a collection of the first viruses that we would encounter from people from station to station. Like there was Lotus 1-3, and there were viruses attacking that, and so on and so forth. So we've watched an evolution of cybersecurity over the years that is exponential, much following, in a sense, the evolution of technology. As the systems became more and more part of everyday life and everyday functions, so has the hacking of the systems, the theft of the systems, the compromise of the systems. And since cybersecurity was always designed as an afterthought to the vast majority of the systems, and today it's an afterthought in the Internet of Things, introducing real and present danger in our everyday life. People can die because of this stuff. It has been exploited, but it has been exploited by nefarious interests, be it people that want to go after the data for money, or political objectives, or nation-state objectives, or even terrorism.
This seems like a good time to mention the very unconventional foreword to your book. Or maybe the foreword itself isn't so unconventional, but certainly the person who has written the foreword of your book is, in a sense, an unconventional yet perfect choice. Explain to our listeners kind of the enigma of what I'm saying here. Who has written the foreword to your book?
The foreword to my book has been written by a very, very famous hacker. And it has been a real pleasure working with him. My first time that I met him, he was delivering a keynote to the Osaka Cybersecurity Conference. So he was there, he was delivering this keynote, And he intrigued me because he comes from New York. I'm from New York. Our business is New York. So I walked up and spoke to him. His nickname as a hacker is Sabu, and his name is Hector Monsegur. And he's now director of security at Reno Security Labs, a very, very respected security company. And I walked up to him, and the two of us just clicked. And I said, I'm working on this book. He immediately agreed about the need for this book and the need to bridge the communications gap and the need to distinguish cybersecurity from technology, because people confuse the two, and also the need to protect our systems. And he agreed, and he was very, very gracious to write the foreword to this book. And Sabu is infamous in the hacker world. He was part of Anonymous. He was arrested and so on and so forth. And one of the points that he's making in the book is, don't make the same mistakes that I did and ended up arrested.
Well, and of course, he, in a sense, helps you understand the mindset of the hacker and the means by which hackers go about doing what they do. To what extent are real-life hackers an important element in the industry of cybersecurity? That is, how much do we end up learning from hackers, whether they're reformed or not, in terms of understanding what is going on and the nature of their attacks?
Well, we end up learning an enormous amount. First of all, hackers are extraordinarily talented individuals. And if they apply their talent towards good, they are white hats. And if they apply their talent towards bad, towards evil, they are black hats. But the first thing that I think we need to set as a baseline here, that somebody being a hacker is a person that is, first of all, extraordinarily talented, much like a musician is talented, and also extraordinarily studied. In order to hack computer systems, you need to understand computer science and security, and to a large extent, you need to understand human behavior as well. So being a successful, world-renowned hacker is a very, very big deal, and they contribute to the field, and they teach us an enormous amount of things. I couldn't possibly have more respect to hackers than I do now, being in the field. They can certainly outsmart any of us, and especially because when we're protecting systems, by default, we're playing defense. Mm. When systems are being attacked, obviously the hacker is playing offense. So the only thing a hacker needs to do for a system is win once. What we have to do as defenders is we cannot afford to lose once. Mm. So we have to protect from a myriad of threats, a constant changing landscape. They need to succeed once, and they have everything on their side. They have time, they have intelligence, they have tools. They can wait you out, and there is no question that if you as an individual, you as a business, you as a state, you as a country, if you are under an advanced persistent threat, you will be compromised. It's not an if. There's just no doubt about that, because there is no way that you can protect any system to that extent. And that's a reality. And part of the thing that people need to understand is, when we're talking about cybersecurity, we're not talking about technology. We're talking about risk. And risk is never zero. Mm. Never.
Mm. We're speaking with Chris Moscovitis about his book, Cybersecurity Program Development for Business, The Essential Planning Guide. You spend quite a portion of the book, in fact, all of the first chapter, to understanding risk. And the concept in particular of risk acceptance. The bottom line, you write, is that we all live with risk every single day of our lives. We constantly make decisions about risk, and when we're done evaluating, we take action signifying our acceptance of this risk. And you say studying risk is taking a trip down a fascinating, complex, and intricate labyrinth. Explain how risk itself is, in a sense, an endlessly fascinating field, and also crucial to the typical business owner understanding the whole notion of cybersecurity.
Well, risk is both an impediment and a driver of innovation and success in the following sense. And you're right. In our daily life, let's start there. In our daily life, we take risk decisions every day. If you are approaching a stoplight, you make a decision if you're going to go through the yellow light or you're going to stop. And you can see how this can differ based on your particular circumstances in the exact same case. So if you're alone in your car and you're in a rush and you're approaching a light and the light is turning yellow and you look left and you look right and you say, I can do this, and you blow through the light, you just made a risk decision. And the risk decision you made was to blow the light. But if your newborn is sitting on the back seat, do you think you would do that even if you're rushed the same way? You wouldn't. You made a different decision because suddenly what changed for you is, what is this worth it? What is this worth it to you? Those are the decisions that we make about risk every day. And the value of intrinsic worth is something that we discuss in psychology, in social sciences, in anthropology, because it changes with time, and it also changes from individual to individual. You can have an entrepreneur that's starting a company and therefore is willing to accept an enormous amount of risk. She may say, damn the torpedoes, I will do whatever in order to have my company succeed. And we may have a more seasoned professional that is more conservative, and she may turn around and say, you know what, no, we got to apply the brakes here a little bit because we need to make sure that everything is protected and things are behind a vault. All of those decisions affect our daily lives, they affect our business lives, and they affect our civic life.
Mm. And I really do like the way you explore this and discuss it, and I think it's very helpful in kind of laying the context then for some of the specifics that follow. You also already in this chapter about risk bring in the concept of controls and the relationship between risk and controls. And you actually spell out, I think, four different categories of controls: preventative, detective, corrective, and compensatory. I had never heard any of this laid out in quite this way, and I found it really, really fascinating. Just explain to our listeners the way in which you're using the basic term of controls in the context of this conversation.
Sure. So controls do stuff. The best way to think of controls is something that does stuff. And what do? Is they mitigate risk. Your goal as a business owner, as an individual, again, no matter what your role is in life, when you assess the risk, when you identify what the assets of value are and you identify the threats against those assets, you are now going to mitigate this risk. You're going to apply controls that mitigate this risk, and you're going to lay out these controls in what we call defense in depth strategy, which means you're going to layer the controls. If one control fails, then the other control is going to catch it. If that control fails, then the other control is going to catch it. That is the defense in depth strategy. So, and there are different classes of controls. There are preventative controls. They're designed to prevent the attack from reaching the asset in the first place. There are detective controls, and those are absolutely critical, and they are designed to identify that an attack is happening, and it will tell you what kind of an attack, where it came from, and so on and so forth. There are the corrective controls, and those are designed to minimize the damage from an attack. And finally, there's compensating controls, which are designed to compensate for either the absence of a control or the failure of a control, because sometimes things may preclude you from applying a control. You may be running a business that has, for example, a mission-critical system that was written in 1970, and it's in COBOL. And it can't go away. This thing is mission-critical to the business. Now, in order for this to go away, you will have to spend, you know, millions of dollars to rewrite it and blah, 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 which is tricky. I mean, it's something that you should do, but you have to plan for it, and it will take years. So you can't just make the system go away, and therefore you cannot apply certain controls to protect that system because it's so old that modern technologies would break it. So how do you compensate for that? Well, maybe you can air gap it, which means unplug that system from the internet so it can't be compromised. Maybe you can layer controls around it. Maybe you can, you know, so there's different ways that you can try to shield that system and compensate for the lack of controls on that system. So that's the whole concept. And that is at once the power and the beauty of cybersecurity. It is not about technology. It is about risk. It is about human behavior. It is about what's worth it to you. And then you apply all these controls, and then you protect the things that are of value to you. That's what cybersecurity does. Versus information technology, IT, what it does is it generates value. IT generates value every single day. Cybersecurity protects that value. There are two parallel tracks. They cannot report to one another, and therefore having this illusion that your IT people are taking care of cybersecurity couldn't be more wrong. They can't be. It's a conflict of interest. You're asking them to generate value as much as possible and as fast as possible, and on the other hand, you say, and while you're doing that, make sure you protect it. That doesn't work.
Right. It's in a sense, two very, very different endeavors.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Very different.
I appreciate also in the chapter where you really unpack that term of cybersecurity, how you really break it down. And at one point you say that the pillars of cybersecurity used to be a triad. There used to be three factors, but now it's a quartet. Now there are four factors of cybersecurity. I wonder if you could spell out what has changed there.
Well, the initial triad of cybersecurity and what people speak of it today is confidentiality, integrity, and availability, right? So you want to protect the confidentiality of data, you want to protect the integrity of this data, and you want to make sure that this data is available. But that's not enough. It's not enough anymore. What you need to add to this triad is safety, because now these systems actually touch living systems. You have intelligent cars. You have intelligent pacemakers. You have intelligent insulin pumps. And you have intelligent toaster ovens, too. But the point of the matter is that now you have a direct impact into the safety of humans and environments. So cybersecurity must extend its confidentiality, integrity, and availability into safety of people and environments.
Mm. We should say that your book goes on to explore all kinds of very important specifics about all of this, and you go beyond the matter of cybersecurity itself to make sure that it is in proper alignment with other facets of your business. And I thought that was really intriguing as well, that in a sense the matter of cybersecurity cannot exist in its own distinct silo. And you say that poor governance and poor management can really lead to a misalignment that can be a very serious problem.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right in saying so. And the easiest way to think of this at the operational level is we spoke about controls earlier. Well, controls cost money, right? Well, controls are there to mitigate risk against what? They're there to mitigate risk against an asset. Well, how much is this asset worth? There is a metric against this asset, be it dollars or be it of personal value. There is something. You can measure it. This is worth to me X. Well, you can't apply more costly controls than the value of the asset, because you are then overprotecting this asset. And how can this happen in a business or in government or even in personal life? When you are throwing technology to cybersecurity, or you're turning security in cybersecurity into some sort of checklist, then you are potentially misaligning the true mission of cybersecurity. You need to do your homework. How much is this worth? How does this relate to the business? How does this relate to my life? And this is the necessary controls that I need to put against it. So, and that's where we see a lot of misalignment in organizations. People don't speak the language. They don't want to learn the language. We also fail to communicate it in a way that is approachable. And then what happens, you have the executive teams and the boards of directors that are saying either, you know, IT is going to deal with that, or just make it go away. You know, buy some service that makes this go away. It doesn't work that way. Risk doesn't work that way. Life doesn't work that way. We cannot wish this away. Not anymore. Not ever again.
Right. And, of course, as I said, you explore all of this in very impressive detail as you help businesses come up with what you like to call defense in depth to really construct the wisest and most effective kind of cybersecurity. One thing I wanted to ask you about as we close is you wrote at the very beginning of the book, our goal is simple when done with this particular section of the book. I'd like you to have the same tech facility you have when talking about your car. This is right. In chapter two, and it just occurs to me that that probably has to be one of the sterner challenges in all of this in terms of writing this kind of book, is that you are getting into matters of technology, and I think you hope that the person holding and reading this book is maybe going to be a baker or a dentist or a whoever, not necessarily well esteemed in any of these technical matters, and you want to make them accessible and understandable. But that's a challenge when you yourself live every day of your lives in this world of technology.
Yes, it is a very big challenge, and a challenge that I have been blessed enough to be able to successfully overcome. You're right. The goal is to create a space and an environment between us where we can have a meaningful conversation. The same kind of meaningful conversation you need to have with your attorney, with your doctor, or your car mechanic. You're never going to be a doctor yourself. You're never going to be a mechanic yourself. You're never going to be a lawyer. You depend on professionals for that expert advice. But you do need to know how to change a tire. You do need to know what a carburetor is. You do need to know what a battery is, so that when the car mechanic says we need to change the battery, you have a sense of what that means and what that's involved and why that may be important. You may not need to necessarily know how to gut the engine and do this and the other, but that's their job. So that's the goal of the book, and I am very, very pleased that it has succeeded in that. And that is the approach that we take when we go and we visit a company. That's the approach that we take. We sit down with people and we speak in plain language about what's going on here. Mm. What are we trying to do? How can we make this work in a pragmatic way for all involved? And my biggest worry is, you know, businesses are starting to wake up, although smaller and mid-sized businesses are still in the dark. And that's very, very dangerous because they are a prime target. But I really worry about our institutions, both governmental institutions and otherwise, because either the lack of resources or the lack of knowledge is really exposing us to very, very serious dangers. Mm.
The book, again, is Cybersecurity Program Development for Business, The Essential Planning Guide, published by Wiley, the author, Chris Moscovitis. Chris Moscovitis, I so enjoyed this conversation and really derived a great deal of value from your fascinating book. Thank you so much for both.
Thank you, Greg. Hope to talk to you again.
The time is 8:37, and you're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to finish out the hour by giving you an encounter with the talented young pianist Baron Ryan, who is one half of the piano duo team of Ryan and Ryan, with his father Donald Ryan, with whom I spoke on the morning show last week. Ahead of my conversation with Baron Ryan, I want to play for you something that gives us a taste of their entertaining artistry together. This is their own duo piano version of David Gruzin's main title theme from the film score to The Firm. And this is from the album of Ryan and Ryan, which is called Face to Face.
And that wonderful piano playing is from the father and son duo team of Ryan and Ryan, Father Donald Ryan and son Baron Ryan, who are coming to Carthage College and performing there tomorrow night as part of Carthage's chamber music series. And those of you who listen very regularly to the morning show might remember my conversation this past Thursday with Donald Ryan. Today we're going to catch up with Donald Ryan's son, Baron Ryan, one half of this very, very exciting musical team. Baron Ryan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I'm really, really happy to have this opportunity. Your dad was a very interesting and charming morning show guest.
I'm not surprised.
So tell us, first of all, what it was like for you to grow up in a household with a father who was a very, very fine professional pianist, and was it just a foregone conclusion that that was something that you yourself were going to do as well?
I was inundated with music from birth, even from before birth, I suppose. I grew up listening to my dad practice and teach piano students in our home, and I went to his piano concerts around Tulsa, Oklahoma, where I grew up and where we both still now live. And so I was just surrounded by music my whole life, and it was not a foregone conclusion that I would be a professional musician, although it was kind of a foregone conclusion that I would at least learn how to play, although I didn't have to be convinced to start piano lessons. I wanted to play as soon as I could. My dad said that he started teaching me lessons, which started at age 4 for me, because he wanted to teach me something useful. Otherwise, I would just walk by the piano and bang away, and he wanted to teach me how to make actual music.
So right.
I was precocious and ready to start.
Right. But, he mentioned that
I would be.
Yeah, he said, you know, you were raring to go. It was not a matter of him urgently trying to persuade you to try the piano. You were absolutely interested in piano in a rather ferocious
yeah.
fashion, right,
yeah.
right from the start. And he was your first teacher. What was that like for your father to be, in a sense, interacting with you in a very different role? Or was he a very fatherly teacher, and did that seem like a very natural and, in a sense, smooth extension of who he was the rest of the time with you?
It seemed like a pretty smooth extension. It wasn't that different being in a lesson and him telling me how to play a particular piece of music, or wasn't that different from cleaning the bathroom and being told that it wasn't good enough. Although that was usually my mom who told me that the bathroom cleaning needed to be better. It was a little trying when I was practicing, and he would say from the other room that I should be playing a G sharp instead of a G natural or something like that. So that was suboptimal for me at the time, although at least I had the problem fixed. But in terms of actual lessons, it wasn't too hard. And then once I got into middle school, we stopped having lessons on a regular basis, and I actually had to bug him to give me lessons because he was busy working, paying for my education, and I was busy being educated.
Fascinating.
So,
your dad?
So we would have a lesson maybe once every month or something like that, starting in middle school.
Your dad confessed that as a youngster, he really hated to practice. He loved to play. He hated to practice. Were you the same, or were you a little more diligent in terms of being willing to spend the time to actually practice and play what you needed to play versus just having fun?
Oh, no, I also hated to practice. I liked performing, and so I practiced as little as necessary to be impressive enough to perform. And that was true until I reached my junior year of high school. Then I thought, okay, I better actually start practicing, and now I enjoy it much more, of course, but it was also a struggle for me when I was younger.
Interesting. I don't think that's an uncommon phenomenon. I know from talking to your dad that there were some other things that sort of entered the picture at certain points in time. It sounds like you played some basketball and also got very, very interested in golf for a while. Explain at what point in time these kind of other pursuits became important to you, and how challenging it was to keep everything, in a sense, sort of properly stacked? Or were there times when piano really was shunted way off to the side for you?
Yes. I would say early in high school, my first 2 years, piano was not a priority. I was playing drums, and I've actually played drums for slightly longer than I've played piano, although I have not taken lessons on a consistent basis on drums ever. So I was playing drums in the jazz band at my high school, and I was playing on the drum line. And I've always been fascinated by trying new things. I've tried other instruments as well, although none of them have stuck. And playing basketball and playing golf, I enjoyed being athletic, and so I wanted to try other things. But I realized as I got toward getting to college, and then as I got toward getting out of college, that I needed to specialize if I wanted to have a marketable skill as any one of the things that I was interested in. And so even now still, I enjoy other pursuits, making videos, although now I can use other pursuits and fold them into the pursuit of playing the piano and sharing joy through music. But I still have to balance making sure that I work on the piano itself as much as I need to. Hmm.
At what point did you and your father begin this collaboration together as a piano duo team? And do you have a vivid memory of when that really began, when either he came to you or you came to him, or you decided together that this would be something interesting to try?
Actually, our first performance was my sophomore year in high school, and the high school came to us because they were purchasing a new 9-foot Steinway piano and wanted an inaugural concert and asked us if we would do it together. And so we said, oh, well, I guess we better come up with some music to play. And that's how we first began playing in a more serious fashion. Before that, I had played in his jazz trio on drums. Actually, no, I hadn't started that yet. But I did play in his jazz trio on drums, I think, beginning a little after that concert. And then I would give home concerts when I was young, starting, I think, at age 5 or 6. I would organize our living room into a concert venue and write out tickets. And the finale of all my concerts was Glenn Miller's In the Mood. And if Dad was there, then he would play piano and I would play the drums, and that would be the grand finish. So that's where we really first started playing together, was for my home concerts at 5 or 6, but in a more serious fashion in my sophomore year of high school.
Wow. At what point did you make a concerted effort, the two of you, to actually form a professional piano duo team? And did you do so with any trepidation?
That happened after I graduated from college, because I realized that I should come up with something to do. And we thought, well, a father-son piano duo team might be an act that audiences would be interested in seeing. And there probably should have been more trepidation on my part than there actually was. I just assumed, oh, my dad is already established, and once we team up together, people are just going to be banging down the doors to see us, and it's not quite that easy. So there was not much trepidation, but it's worked out so far.
One of the questions I asked your dad is if he's the boss in this team. I mean, if he is the person who kind of does most of the guiding and most of the deciding and so on. And he really answered with an emphatic no, that at least in his mind, the two of you are at least he hopes, are a 50-50 team. I wonder if that's the way it feels to you, and if you can just say a little bit more of the nature of your collaboration.
Yes, I would say that is true, that it is a 50-50 team. I think that the two of us have, it's not 50-50 in everything. Where I am on social media, and I'm a bit more social media savvy than he is, and so I take responsibility more for our Facebook page and our online marketing. And he has, well, I generally, I sometimes play too loud when he has the melody, so he's more often telling me to listen to him playing melody, so I don't play the accompaniment as loud. But it is, we talk about our programs together and come to consensus. So I would agree that it is a 50-50 partnership, although not always equal in every particular facet of what we do.
You have a reputation, you and your father, for playing very entertaining concerts that include a wide swath of musical styles. Is there a particular style that feels particularly at home to you, or really for you and your father, is it all great music and all equally meaningful and satisfying and pleasurable to play?
It is, I would say much of it is equally satisfying and pleasurable, but in different ways. And so I think one thing that we do really well is play our own arrangements, which is that makes obvious sense. But we will end our first half with two arrangements that my dad did and one arrangement that I did. And they play to our strengths because we get to write them to our strengths. But we're also very good at playing ragtime together as a team. And those performances always go off well when we play ragtime. We're including some strictly classical works on this concert tour, a couple of pieces by Sergei Rachmaninoff. We haven't usually played anything by Mozart or Beethoven. Well, Beethoven doesn't have any two-piano music, to my knowledge, but we haven't usually played strictly Western classical music. But we decided to on this program because the music is so good and because people want to hear us play it, because we talk about being classically trained, but we haven't played anything strictly classical. So I love the music that we were playing by Rachmaninoff is as good writing as exists for two pianos. And so it's just a pleasure to play that, but in a different way than it is to play this version of What a Friend We Have in Jesus that I wrote to be in the style of soul, Motown, and Jackson 5.
Interesting. fun. Have you ever tried your hand, you and your father, at piano four hands? To explain to our listeners, that would be the two of you sitting on one bench in front of one piano and playing together, which is a related but also very different sort of venture. Is that anything you have done at all, or have you been strictly two piano duo pianists?
We have done that some. In fact, our very first concert when I was in high school was one piano, four hands. But we find that is limiting for us because we're both used to playing on an entire keyboard, and then when you play on one piano, you get only half that. And so we do that and can play featured performances for two, three, or four selections. But to play an entire concert on one piano, we find is too restrictive. So we prefer to.
Very good. Well, I know a lot of people are really, really excited about this concert, which is coming up tomorrow night at Carthage College as part of Carthage's Chamber Series. And I know that part of your visit to Southeast Wisconsin also includes some educational outreach. And it sounds like for both you and your father, this is really important to you.
Yes. Well, music for us is not just about having a good time and playing, or even having a good time in people listening, but having it be an example of an aspiration that can be achieved, something beautiful that you can create if with the right amount of dedication and vision. And so we want to instill and encourage other people to create beauty in the world and create meaning however they can, whether it be through music, or maybe our music helps inspire them to do that in a different way that they're particularly suited at. And so we look forward to and relish the opportunities that we have to play for students and to play in settings that are that can inspire people to reach more in their own lives.
Mm. Baron Ryan and his father Donald Ryan, as the duo of Ryan and Ryan, play tomorrow night at Carthage College as part of their chamber music series. Baron Ryan, it's been a great delight to speak with you today, and I know lots of people are excited about tomorrow night's concert, me included. We wish you safe travels and much continued success.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
And in the last couple minutes of today's program, let's enjoy the last couple of minutes of Ryan and Ryan performing George Gershwin's remarkable Rhapsody in Blue, also from their album called Face to Face. Donald Ryan and his talented son, Baron Ryan. Ryan and Ryan, they perform at Carthage College tomorrow night at 7:30 as part of Carthage's Chamber Music Series. This concert is open to the public, and you can purchase your tickets by visiting www.carthage.edu/tickets, or you can call the Fine Arts Box Office, 551-6661. I believe the box office is only open for business Tuesdays through Fridays, noon to 5, so that would be tomorrow afternoon if you want to call. Otherwise, tickets should be available for purchase at the door as well. And more information is available at carthage.edu. Click on the link for The Bridge. Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll be talking about the Kenosha Public Library's Big Read events coming up, and we'll also preview a fascinating